Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 345.
This week on the podcast, get ready for a week in which everything will be constantly compared to Pearl Harbor.
And we smashed the record for unemployment claims. Just slaughtered it.
Turns out that when 10 million people are suddenly unemployed, Medicare for All sounds like a great plan.
Plus, the Democratic convention is being pushed. But no stupid deadly virus is going to stop the Wisconsin primary, whether or not they have polling places, poll workers, or even voters.
Plus, the Republican governors are proving they're actually as science challenged as the characters they play on TV.
And California is either doing a bang-up job, or it isn't. The numbers tell many stories.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yes.
Welcome to week 800 of the pandemic. We are still broadcasting from two separate locations.
We'll be for another month, by the way.
We'll be potentially forever, potentially for 18 months. Nobody seems to know. Listen, I've almost completed my first jigsaw puzzle. I feel like I can tell that I'm distracted because normally I'm really good at jigsaw puzzles. I have like a gift with those kinds of spatial relationships. And so normally I finish a jigsaw puzzle in like a few hours. And I have been sitting with this jigsaw puzzle for like days just because I just like don't want it to finish. I don't want to have to be like stuck trying to figure out what to do once the jigsaw puzzle is done. So, So I'm living the jigsaw puzzle life.
Yeah. Thinking about what you're going to do when the puzzle is over with is terrifying.
It's really the
I haven't done a puzzle
times.
Yet, but I've been having similar feelings about television shows that I've started.
Oh my God.
It took us 2 weeks to watch Tiger King,
most
everyone watched in one sitting, but I felt great about that because
I couldn't have been happier. And then I started another show that only had 4 episodes and I finished it that night and I was like beside myself that I hadn't had the self-control to like stretch it over another week.
Is this unorthodox?
Yeah, it was unorthodox.
Yeah, I watched it yesterday. There's not anything better that you can be watching right now.
I mean, everyone should just immediately... It's 4 hours of your life that you need 4 hours of your life taken from you at this point. Like, there's
so
no...
Good.
It's not... There's no reason to say the usual saying of it's 4 hours of your life you can't get back. Like, we're trying... Like, you have, like, too much time to give now. So, watch unorthodox. And then... So, I think... The thing that we're going to be doing on this podcast is, A, we're going to be trying once again to make sure that you are informed about all the electoral news that you need to know about, because obviously that's getting pushed farther and farther down the main page of the news, of the newspaper sites that we are, you know, of the newspaper sites. That's being pushed down farther in the news websites. But also we want to talk about what we can learn from this moment in terms of policy and how we should move forward from this moment, not just thinking about how we can fix this pandemic situation that we've found ourselves in, but also how we can protect ourselves via policy from this and other similar fates in a more productive and expansive way.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of, you know, we're going to reference like a couple op-eds that were written this week. There's been a million of them. So you can find them easily. But, you know, I think a lot of And what's great about these op-eds is that you don't have to look for them sort of like on the fringe left websites any longer.
Right.
Like some of these ideas or the push to have ideas are in the main, like,
and we were at
our
a point
idea
where
is
we,
to have ideas.
We needed the conversation about it being okay to have ideas to start. That's how far behind the eight ball that we were.
Yeah, exactly. But there was, there were a couple, and actually they were both in the Financial Times, the ones that we're going to reference. One of them, the first one was actually written by their editorial board, which should be noted is something because, you know, they're not necessarily like a conservative rag, but they're not necessarily out there sort of like trying to get us, turn us all into socialists either. But they sort of wrapped up theirs with said, and it, I'm just going to read a bit of it. It said, radical reforms, reversing the prevailing policy direction of the last 4 decades, will need to be put on the table. Governments will have to accept a more active role in the economy. They must see public services as investments rather than liabilities and look for ways to make labor markets less insecure. Redistribution will again be on the agenda, the privileges of the elderly and wealthy in question. Policies until recently considered eccentric, such as basic income and wealth taxes, will have to be in the mix. So that's from the Financial Times editorial board.
Mainstream news sources are A, starting to sing the praises of universal basic income, which is another great reminder of why you need primaries, because we wouldn't be having the vocabulary to discuss that idea if it weren't something that had come to us on the national stage at some point. Right. So, we really owe Andrew Yang a debt of gratitude, not because he invented the idea of universal basic income. UBI has been in the mix in lefty political circles for a long time. But because he gave the entire nation the language to talk about it so that when this extreme situation came to us, we actually were armed with an idea that could help solve it.
Yeah.
And that's the same with wealth taxes and the Sanders and Warren, tax plans. Totally. Is without giving people the language to discuss a wealth tax and without making that a mainstream conversation, whether or not it was a mainstream position, no one has the ability to sort of easily jump to that conclusion when a crisis hits. But we are now sort of at the tail end of a very exciting primary process that kind of put all of these ideas into the mix, and we should vow to learn from them.
Totally.
We should make sure that our response to this is not short-sighted and is not, I feel like I've been seeing a lot of calls to make broad changes to the way that wealth is held in this country and the way that it's distributed. And what I'm seeing is policy suggestions being made on the political end that are aiming to solve only the immediate crisis in front of us. It's kind of the Joe Biden, we'll cover everyone's healthcare for coronavirus should be covered. But of course, there are many ways in which coronavirus can impact your health in other broader ways. There's mental health complications that are going to be related to it. But there's also the fact that 20 years from now, you might have lung issues related to the time you had coronavirus. And that should also be something you can get covered. Totally. So the idea of, wedging a small policy solution into a big, broad problem like this is something that we're going to need to move away from. And it's something that, oddly, the media has really been leading the charge to move away from.
Right. Yeah.
That's what's been kind of interesting about this moment.
Totally.
But Arundhati Roy also wrote an op-ed in the Financial Times that sort of similarly encourages us, and talking specifically about the response in India, but encourages us to really think about sort of more broadly what normalcy means and whether we should be even aiming to return to that.
Right. And I would highly recommend reading this whole op-ed, because the response to the coronavirus in India is shameful in a way that you really need to read this, because it is almost unbelievable what they're doing right now. So.
Right. Well, also, Arundhati Roy is a great writer. So.
Well, yeah, she's a great writer. And she we'll read this for you too. I was going to say, she wrote God of Small Things. She won the Man Booker Prize. I mean, she sort of says similarly what their editorial board said, but just in a more artful way. She said, this is a little bit longer, but I think it's worth reading because it is.
People have nothing but time, Brent. Just go for it.
I know, right? Like, sure, I should have just read the whole thing. We should have done a dramatic reading of the entire thing. It would have taken an hour. But anyway, she said, coronavirus has made the mighty kneel and brought the world to a halt like nothing else could. Our minds are still racing back and forth, longing for a return to normality, trying to stitch our future to our past and refusing to acknowledge the rupture. But the rupture exists. And in the midst of this terrible despair, it offers us a chance to rethink the doomsday machine we have built for ourselves. Nothing could be worse than a return to normality. Historically, pandemics have forced humans to break with the past and imagine their world anew. This one is no different. It is a portal, a gateway between one world and the next. We can choose to walk through it, dragging the carcasses of our prejudice and hatred, our avarice, our data banks and dead ideas, our dead rivers and smoky skies behind us. Or we can walk through it lightly with little luggage, ready to imagine another world and ready to fight for it. So I just think that as you are watching the news this week, as you are listening to the podcast now, let some of those things frame you. And we're going to start with some stories that we feel like, speak to that.
And also require an optimistic framing. This is your opportunity to look at the news with optimism as opposed to just total despair. Because we used to always talk about the now infamous saying that my mom had of nothing can't be undone. But also, on the other side of that is we made the whole thing up so we can fix anything we decide to.
Totally. And I also think that we're going to enter the phase, and I haven't necessarily heard this specifically yet, but I feel like we're sort of in that time where after a major mass shooting, we're always told to like not get political with it. Like now is not the time to play politics. And I feel like we're sort of, I'm getting the sense of that, that like we're going to start hearing like, oh, well, we just all need to come together now. And like, and all of those things are true. But like, now is the time to play politics with this.
Well, I was going to say, we need to come together, you, like,
it's make sure your elderly neighbors. Right. It's right. Exactly. Right. But it's political solutions that are going to fix where we are currently, and also political solutions that are going to allow us to not be in this situation again and to have a society that works better for all of our people. Well, and so we have to think about what those solutions are, and they're all political solutions.
Also,
so
the problem we're facing is a political problem. This was a this is a political problem of our own making. You know, the fact that we don't have a social safety net to account for people's health and well-being, or to sort of protect people's health and well-being during a major crisis. The fact that we have a federal government that doesn't believe in science and therefore put off dealing with this pandemic until it was too late. All of those are political problems. So when you're thinking about how to solve these problems, there's the part of it that's like, make sure your community is taken care of. Make sure elderly people and sick people in your community can get food and toilet paper and things like that. But part of solving this problem is inherently political, because the problem is political.
Right.
And I think when you... And that's the same with mass shootings. I mean, that's why that's a frustrating talking point for mass shootings, because the problem was political. That was an annoying thing that I constantly hear that about 9/11, you know, that we all came together as one and it wasn't political. And like, that was a political problem that had political consequences, certainly for me, but also for millions of Americans, and also millions of people in the Middle East. And so that was a problem. These are problems that require political solutions. So it's okay to be political.
Yeah.
Agreed. So think about that while you hear the news that this week is going to be the worst of the crisis so far.
Yeah.
We are looking at, according to the Surgeon General, kind of the most deadly, most kind of despairing week of coronavirus cases that we're going to see, at least in the hot spots as they exist right now. Jerome Adams, the Surgeon General, said the next week is going to be our Pearl Harbor moment. It's going to be our 9/11 moment. It's going to be the hardest moment for many Americans in their entire lives. And we really need to understand that if we want to flatten the curve and get through to the other side, everyone needs to do their part. Now, I would note that 9/11, if you are over 30, is already a huge crisis that you've handled. So this, all this reference made me think of was, I was like, again? How many of these? Like, these are not once in a generation problems. These have been hitting our generation too much.
Well, yeah, for sure. And we're also, you know, we're now in our, I mean, they keep telling us that we're not in a recession. Like, everybody, oh no, we're not in a recession.
We're
like,
literally in a recession.
We shut down the economy. So like, the unemployment numbers are fake and who cares, because like, we decided to do this and we have to do that. But like, you know, we're also within the last 12 years in our second recession.
Right.
Well, but also, lazy millennials.
All recessions are man-made because the economy is man-made.
Well,
when people act like the economy is like this thing that happens without any action, recessions are caused by choices that people make. We made up money. We made up the stock market. We made the whole thing up. So when it's doing badly, it's because of choices we made. It's not because of just like, it's like the way of nature. It's not like a tornado.
Right.
You know, it's like, so, you know, keep that in mind, as all of these crises can be fixed because they're all made up.
Yeah.
But also the economic crisis that we are going to be in is one that we have in some ways created for ourselves. And it doesn't also matter why it happened. It just matters that it did happen.
Correct. Yeah.
And it's not going to help that these relief checks that we've been waiting on are not going to be coming for another few weeks. It sounds like...
Yeah, I hope you don't need those until September.
Right. Also, I hope that somehow $1,200 is going to solve this crisis. One payment of $1,200 will solve the financial crisis that your sudden unemployment has landed you in with no problems. Because, so it looks like, according to a memo that was circulated by the House and the Democrats on the House Ways and Means Committee, it sounds like people who have their direct deposit information on file with the government are likely to get payments in the week of April 13th. Now, the Treasury is saying it will be by April 15th. There's a little bit of disagreement about the timetable for all of this. That's about 60 million Americans, or according to the Treasury, 50 to 70 million Americans, which is like, that's not a 60. Different number. They acted like that was a different number, like they were refuting the numbers from the Democrats. It's the same number. But then people who don't have direct deposit information on file with the IRS, which includes a lot of people who don't make enough money to file taxes, and things like that, are, because they're waiting for paper checks, are probably not going to even start get receiving checks until around May 4th. Now, the government also says that they're going to start doing this, or the Treasury says they're going to start doing this a few weeks before. But either way, if you are somebody who's waiting on a paper check, you're looking at potentially a 5-month span before they're able to actually process all the checks.
Right.
So that's
September.
September. So they're going to do it. The paper checks are going to go to the lowest income people first and then go outwards from there. But that obviously is going to have accidental loopholes. That's going to have problems. And also, people are in a crisis right now. Like, people need food.
Well, that's the thing. We have to, like, this money has to get into people's hands, right. And it has to get into their hands ASAP. I mean, $1,200 in September doesn't do anybody any good. I mean, it might, but it won't if you
it's better than not getting $1,200.
Well, right, exactly.
That's barely a discussion that we should be having at this point. Right. Now, if you're wondering what the scale of the problem is and why people need this money immediately, we smashed last week's record-setting unemployment claim numbers.
Yeah, we doubled it.
We doubled it. There were 6.6 new unemployment claims done this week. And we could have expected that it would rise like this because this is the week that suddenly, you know, self-employed people and other people who didn't meet the traditional unemployment criteria were able to file. But this also means there's going to be delays in those resources going out as well, because a lot of this is going through state systems. They don't have the resources to
process this many claims. This doesn't get processed for – these claims don't get processed for a while.
No. And so that's like literally the number of first-time claims for unemployment have gone up by – more than 3,000% since early March. Not 300%.
Yeah.
3,000%. 6.6 million workers is like an actual sizable portion of the economy, but also like a sizable portion of the population.
It's in the between this week and last week, which amounts to about 10 million people. That's 6% of our workforce.
That's also, I want to point out, 6.6 million people is more than the population of Iowa and New Hampshire combined.
Yes. And also, it's going to be that bad, presumably, next week.
Of course, because it is complicated as a self-employed person to figure out how to file these claims as well. I know, because I did one last week.
Totally.
It's something
And this is why I think that there is finally starting to be some discussion, and certainly you've been hearing it from Bernie Sanders. And I think initially, I think a lot of people sort of like thought he was nuts, but that is often what happens with Bernie Sanders. But like what he has been saying is that we need to be, yes, giving people money and getting it out as quickly as possible. But also what we should be doing is making sure that people stay on payrolls.
Yeah.
Because A, it would alleviate things like this. You could still do it. You could just invent another, $1 trillion to do it. I think I saw him on The View the other day. I think he said it was going to be like $800 billion or something.
Listen, guys, modern monetary theory is now real. It's real. That's how we're living our lives. Like, so just roll with
it. But also, I think the broad point is that like you wouldn't be having to deal with it wouldn't be crumbling sort of like infrastructures in the way, like infrastructures to get this money out. Like the state of California doesn't have an infrastructure to like process a couple million. Unemployment claims. So the idea, but so not only that, it also keeps the economy going in the way that when this is finally over, then it's just there how you left it.
Yeah.
As opposed to having to rebuild it from having God knows how many tens of millions of people who are unemployed when this thing is all said and done.
Right. Who are so all like, then going to have to be competing with each other for jobs that they used to all already have.
Right. That won't exist because when you think about all of the places that are going to shut down, like so many people who work in hospitality, I mean, restaurants aren't going to immediately reopen. Like that's the other thing. Like if you don't sort of ensure not only that the business stays open, but people can stay on the payroll, it's not going to – Trump keeps talking about how like we're going to just like explode when this thing is over and everybody can go back to work. And that's just not – actually the case because there's gonna businesses are going to be shuttered. The workforce, like you said, is going to be competing for all of these jobs more than exist. And, it's going to be another one of those things where like a bunch of people are going to continue to be unemployed. And then you're going to have a bunch of assholes, mostly Republicans, but not all Republicans, unfortunately, who are just going to be telling people, like, I don't know why they just don't take a shower and go back to work. I mean, we're going to have another sort of like Occupy situation. I'm not saying that there will be a you know, that type of protest going on, but there might be.
I mean, there might be. There's going to be a lot of people who don't really have any homes to go to.
Right. But I think sort of just shutting everything down and then trying to deal with tens of millions of unemployment claims and trying to get paper checks out to tens of millions of people, like, is just not it.
Well, and there's also another aspect of this, which is that if you're really putting your economy on freeze, as they keep saying that we're doing, you have to freeze rent and mortgage payments.
Well, right.
You know, you can't, people's payments haven't gone away. So the reason everyone's in crisis right now is because their bills are still coming. They just don't have jobs.
Right.
So if you want to actually put a country on freeze, then you have to make it so that people can afford to freeze. And you have to do, you give them $1,200 so they can buy food, but you do not then ask them to pay rent with that $1,200. You don't ask them to pay for their health insurance premium with that $1,200. You know, that, like, there's all of these additional expenses that are in other countries being being dealt with in different ways, and in some cases in ways where people are not going to then owe that money at the end, because now they're saying, oh, if you skip rent, you know, if you miss rent, you have 12 months to pay it back. But it's like, what, without a job, how are you paying it back at the end of all of this?
Right.
I mean, it wasn't your choice to come and sit at home for 3 months. So, like, it's not like you were just too lazy to go get a job, which is going to be what they tell you. So just be prepared for that. But it's a good also time to think about whether we want to still be tying healthcare to unemployment.
Right. 2 weeks. In the last 2 weeks, 10 million people have lost their jobs and all lost their healthcare.
That's right.
Now, you could probably keep your healthcare with COBRA, which costs $1 zillion that you can't pay for because you don't have a job. So COBRA has always been one of the world's dumbest things in my mind.
Yeah.
Because it's actually sort of like, oh, well, you know, you've been laid off, but you can keep your healthcare for like 7 times the actual price of your healthcare through your employer.
There is only one situation.
But also you're not making any money. So
exactly.
Like,
there is one situation in which COBRA makes sense. And it is if you have to span a 1 month gap between jobs and you need to not have your deductible reset. Because the other thing no one's talking about, because no one knows this, is that all of these people, when if they do have to go into the exchanges and buy healthcare, all of their deductibles are reset when they purchase that new plan, which means any money that they spent on healthcare trying to meet their deductible up until now disappears.
Gone.
So they are actually going to be on the hook for even more money than they would have been if they were just able to continue with their plans and pay the COBRA costs. But the COBRA costs are going to be so outrageous monthly that they're not going to be able to. So this is like a ridiculous, this is a man-made problem. It's a ridiculous problem to put
people. We have a pandemic, and the pandemic causes people to lose their jobs. And because these people lost their jobs, they can't have the healthcare that they would need in the middle of a pandemic.
That's right.
I mean, it is actually insane enough that you are, if you are still a person who thinks that your healthcare should be tied to employment, I don't know how to help you.
Truly. And if you're a person who is sitting and thinking to yourself, but I just want to make sure I keep my plan, just know that all of us not having a plan really makes your health, imperils your health now. Like this is the perfect example of why widespread healthcare protects everyone's health, because widespread access to preventative care helps people stay healthy to not make you sick. Like your gold-plated plan does not do much for you if you can't, if you get sick anyway in a pandemic, and you know, there's still going to be shortages in the hospitals that you go to. There's still going to be sort of, you know, expenses that you're going to owe that you're not going to really be able to afford to owe, because no one's healthcare actually protects them from this kind of catastrophic need, you know, like the ICU for 2 weeks kind of catastrophic need.
Right.
And also, you should know that you can lose your job at any moment, at any moment, for reasons that have nothing to do with anything.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing, is if you're thinking about this and you're thinking, well, I have a good union job and whatever, you can just fucking lose that job.
That's right.
Turns out.
Yeah.
Turns out. All of this has led to a spike in support for Medicare for All, unsurprisingly.
Thank God.
I mean, if ever there was a situation that painted our need for Medicare for All in a simple, easy to understand way.
And I would assume that this number is going to continue to go up, and it's going to be tied literally to unemployment claims.
Yeah, agreed.
I mean, watch these numbers go together. I mean, there was a poll that came out that Politico did with Morning Consult, and it was from the 27th through the 29th. So at this point, it's already outdated as fast as the news is moving here. But right. It showed that 55% of voters back Medicare for All. That's the highest level it's been since June 2019. I don't know what was going on then, but anyway. And it's nearly equal the record of 56%, which was reported in January of 2019. So that is on the rise. So
also, what's on the rise is the percentage of vote, the net support for it. So it used to be that more voters opposed it, and also, you know, that this many voters wanted it, but more voters opposed it. Now only 35% of voters oppose it, which is a 9-point jump from February of last year. And that means that there is a 20-point margin between
swing.
The number of people who, you know, support it and don't support it, which is bigger than it used to be. So that's meaningful as well, because people dropping their abject hatred for Medicare for All is as important to us getting it as people believing it's the best policy.
Yes.
Meanwhile, if you are wondering if believing in science can still get you killed in America, it can, because Dr. Fauci is now needing a security detail. Because
hey, he's getting threats.
He's getting threats.
For safety.
Because he's trying to tell us about science.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, so
science,
here's
bad.
Here's
correcting Trump,
right.
Bad.
Exactly.
Like, that's really what it's not even that he believes in science. It's just that he has the gall to sort of say something different than the president does.
Right. From a place of expertise, as opposed to just from a place of random rambling, which where the president's been saying it.
Yeah.
Here's what's happening on the political front. The Democratic convention has now been pushed to August. That was the kind of first big news of the week. The DNC decided on Thursday that the convention, which it had originally been scheduled for July 13th through 16th, is now going to happen in mid-August, just a week before the RNC was already scheduled. This is a really recent change, because as recently as a couple weeks ago, Tom Perez was telling people that there was no idea that they were going to cancel the convention. Or there was no chance they were going to cancel the
convention. And who knows whether it's going to even be able to be done in August.
Right.
I mean, I understand why you sort of like have to set a date, because if you're going to work to try and do it at a certain time, then you have to pick a date and you sort of like have to sort of like re-plan, I guess, to a degree. But like Joe Biden himself this week said that he thinks that it might have to do, might have to be virtual.
I mean,
who knows what that would look like? But he said that we need to think about that.
But it's something that we should be planning for, because
he was like, we might not be able to put 10, 20, 30,000 people in one place. And he's right about that.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that point in a second, because he said something that completely contradicted it about, you know,
classic
another story that we're going to get
Biden
to in a
style.
But,
he's talking a lot with a lot of different thoughts are competing for airtime in his head.
Yeah.
He's also started looking, he's starting to vet VP options now.
Sure.
This is an overblown news story though, because this is something that all candidates do around this time.
I agree with you. I'm assuming that probably Bernie Sanders is doing it. I mean,
I was going to say, at some point, you have to.
If only just for fun.
Right.
I mean, but like,
you have to have a vetted list of candidates so that you are ready to offer it to somebody when you need to.
And Biden apparently called Sanders to tell him that he was doing it.
Right.
So
And also was called him aware that he had not yet won the nomination, which was, I think, you know, the news is trying to spin it like he's doing this because he's the clear victor. He still is 774 delegates short of the number of delegates he needs to lock up the nomination.
Right.
So as much as he is in the lead, certainly, I'm not disputing that. I am arguing that there is not actually a meaningful sort of decision that we can jump to here. Like, we are all talking like he's already the nominee, but he's not yet. And a lot of the races that he's going to need to win to lock it up are now happening far into the future. So We're still in a world where he has to compete to be the president.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yes.
I mean, we're still in that world. So this is not, though, as much of a blunder for his campaign as it was for the people writing headlines about his campaign.
Yeah, I don't think it was that big of a deal. Like I said, I think Sanders is probably doing it.
Yeah.
I have been saying for a while that I think it would probably behoove Sanders to say
who his
running mate would be. I mean, that person may not sort of like want to go down that road, knowing that like he sort of like has a, you know, fairly distant shot at actually winning. But I mean, like, you know, we're living in wild times. Like, announce your cabinet. Like, I don't care. And if Joe Biden wants to say who his VP is, like, I would also be fine with that. I mean, is it presumptuous? Sure. But I mean, like, I don't care. Whatever. You know?
Right. I mean this is, we're in the Wild West right now. Like,
right? What are we doing? He's got all the time on his hand to be reading files about potential VP candidates.
I was going to say,
right,
he's certainly not spending it speaking to the American people. So,
Not in any sort of meaningful way. I mean, he's trying, but he went on this week today. Right. And he's been doing his press conferences, I think. And he released a podcast that was 5 days old by the time it came out.
Also, guys, I want to discuss the podcast because the podcast is called Here's the Thing. And I feel like, okay, call it Here's the Thing because you are, you know, Ezra Klein.
Sure.
Do not call it Here's the Thing when you are asking us for our vote. Call it I'm Listening. Like, right. do not have a podcast whose theme is I'm not listening, basically. I'll tell you what's what. Like, that is a crazy thing to do. And also, it just shows disrespect for the voters, which, I mean, I get that we're all proceeding as if he's the nominee anyway, but, like, I don't need the presidential candidate to tell me what's what. I need him to listen to me when I tell him what's what.
Yeah.
That's his job.
I also need him to be able to turn a podcast around in between 12 and 24 hours.
The day that they released that podcast, we also released a podcast, but we had recorded it the day before, 12 hours before it was
actually
released.
It was on our website. I mean, we didn't post that it was up. Within hours.
Yeah.
It was done.
That's how, but the reason that they're doing podcast is a good format for him because he makes a lot of gaffes. But if you need 5 days to edit it, then that has been too many gaffes and we should not trust the content of that podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
5 days to edit a podcast is too many days. We're not talking about professional radio, you guys. This is not a radio package. We're talking about some rinky-dink thing that any idiots, including us, can just record in their homes. So there is sort of an interesting conversation shaping up around 2024 as well because of the number of governors that are really stepping up. And we talked a little bit about this sort of like draft Cuomo movement. That's this nascent draft Cuomo movement that's coming from both the right and the left. But we should note that Gavin Newsom has also been getting a lot of accolades. Gretchen Whitmer has also, you know, after she, you know, got slammed by Trump, has actually been working really hard to quell
Jay Inslee has been talked about more than he ever was. And that's a man who actually did run for president.
Exactly.
But I have to say, I have been watching Newsom's press conferences this week. Mm-hmm. He is also really good. I mean, I was talking about sort of like how good I thought those Cuomo press conferences were. Right. But also, I think that like just as far as sort of like just general decision making from the start, I think that like Gavin Newsom is the winner on that
front.
He's
the winner.
If we're keeping score on who's doing this right,
absolutely.
I mean, then it's him by a long shot.
It's him by a long shot, and he's not. I have a theory about why he's not getting the same accolades as Cuomo. In part because we don't have as big a crisis here because of decisions that Newsom made.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's like Cuomo's getting all the because like he's, you know, he's really the one that's sort of like having to deal with like
rightfully
true disaster there.
He's in a real disaster situation,
and Newsom isn't. But that's also because
he made some good decisions.
He made some good decisions. Right.
And also, I think the time difference works in Cuomo's favor.
It totally does.
Because Newsom's press conferences happen after news is already over on the East Coast. So no one is talking about it. But I did actually just hear today that Newsom is starting a sort of consortium so that states can work together to purchase PPE and ventilators instead of competing for them with each other. That way they can avoid getting gouged for prices.
Nice.
And I was like, I mean, you know, there's already a body that's supposed to be doing this because we are in a consortium of states. It's called the United States of America, and we have a group of people who are responsible for organizing collective responses like this, and that's the federal
government.
Despite
what Jared Kushner says.
Right. However, given that we lack federal leadership in this moment, Newsom is basically stepping up to organize states. And, I mean, this is an interesting thing coming from him because in a battle of who can pay the most for PPE and ventilators,
it would be us.
So he is doing this in order to sort of keep the system going and keep the nation going. He's not doing that. Like, California would win that battle. So he's doing this because he recognizes that this is more than just California's battle. And that's really what the federal government is not doing.
Right. Exactly. And he's just so the other thing, too, I was reading something about him where because like he will rattle off facts. I mean, he knows numbers. He knows like which hospitals need certain things in a way that is like very impressive. And apparently he also doesn't read from a prompter. Apparently he's very dyslexic.
Oh,
yeah.
Fascinating. So he just memorizes the stuff.
He just memorizes everything. And he like actually really like studies these things in a way where he often doesn't even have notes.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I know.
What a Well, that's a useful problem for us in the moment because it means he's had to actually like know what the numbers
are. Read things.
Right. No. He has to actually memorize.
Or have been told. I mean, maybe he didn't read them himself. But
Yeah.
But I also, you know, this is interesting because it's sort of a bummer that, and I'm not saying Jay Inslee was the best presidential candidate at all, but like, I think that I'm fairly certain that I could go back probably 2 years, like as soon as Trump got elected, to say that I think that we were going to be pining for someone with some executive experience in 2020. And I didn't know that it was going to be because of a global pandemic, but like, I do wish that, and look, it seems like our bench is maybe like getting better. You know, I think people are sort of like, definitely, you mentioned Gretchen Whitmer, and also Joe Biden is thinking about her for a vice presidential candidate. I don't necessarily think that's the right choice, but there are governors out there who are doing good things right now, but it's a bummer. I feel like if we had a real badass governor right now as our presidential candidate, I think we would be in great shape right now.
Yeah, I mean, we would have someone who has the ability to get up and give competing press conferences, which is what Cuomo also and Newsom are doing every day. Totally. Every day they get up and give a more informative and more impactful press update than the president, which is exactly what you would want the candidate to be able to do in a situation like this.
Yeah.
And instead you have a candidate who only recently got high-speed internet into his home. Also, he did reiterate that he is going to pick a female running mate. So I feel like now is the time for us to cull a list of all the worst women that we can think of, because one of them is going to be his choice. So if you are someone who has a theory about who the worst possible choice for female running mate for Joe Biden would be.
Right.
And that could be an Amy Klobuchar, just because they're running identical platforms at that point and there's no outreach to the left. That could be someone as awful as a Republican woman that he is looking to. And someone also, like, I had a concern that there would be someone in the genre of like a Meg Whitman that would be on his, that he'd be his choice. Like someone, I mean, not her, but like something in that field.
Sure, sure.
The corporate sort of working,
you know,
the corporate executive leadership person.
Yeah.
Whoever it ends up being, it will be from a list of the worst choices. Yeah. So we have to start thinking about who the worst female VP candidates
would be. Yeah, dust off your old binder full of worst women.
So if you have a binder full of women, this is a good time to take a quick look through that. Just circle all the worst choices. That way we get a short list together. I just don't want to be surprised when it turns out it's someone awful. Because I know it's going to be someone awful. So like, why put myself through the emotional roller coaster?
Yeah, I agree.
I want a binder full of women that is the people that it's going to be, so that I am not shocked when it's one of them. I just need to be prepared. Back to executive leadership, speaking of governors, there are some non-Cuomo Newsom governors that are making some markedly terrible choices out there.
Yes.
The first,
and they're not all
list.
Republicans. Most they're of not them all Republicans. Are, 9 out of 10 are Republicans.
Right. But they're not
the
all Republicans.
The 10th one is Tony Evers from Wisconsin.
You guys... Wisconsin is still planning to have their primary this week.
Yeah, that's right. Tuesday. They are having in-person voting on Tuesday.
What is our advice for these people? Because don't die because you needed to vote in the primary. I mean, there's just not...
Yeah. Well, the governor, Tony Evers, has been all over the map on this. And that is where the problem has been.
Yeah.
Because, and Democrats, elected officials in his state have been like apoplectic over like his handling of this, because he didn't ask to push the primary until Friday.
Yeah.
As in 4 days before the primary.
That's right. As in the Friday that just passed. So we're talking about 2 days ago on the Sunday that we're recording this, and also 3 days ago on the Monday that you're listening to this.
Correct. Yes.
For a Tuesday election.
That's right. So he called a special like 11th hour legislative session, which is their Wisconsin legislature is Republican led. So they showed up, gaveled in and gaveled out in seconds and didn't take any action, which look is douchey. I mean, for sure. I mean, they're basically like, Democrats, go kill yourselves while you vote. I mean, that's ultimately what they've said.
Yeah.
So like, they have some responsibility here too. I mean, let's not put it like they could have They could have just been like, yes, we'll push it to May 26th or whenever. But May 26th is the date that Evers said that he wanted to push it to, and he was like, let's do it all by mail, and we can wait until the 26th to collect all of the votes. But, like, he just came up with that idea, like, Friday.
This is really an example of executive leadership not working out well. So
that's right.
When we talk about examples of good executive leadership, we also have some examples of indecisive bullshit that yeah. is going to lead to chaos.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing democratic about holding an in-person election on the Tuesday of a pandemic during right. what is projected to be the worst week of the pandemic.
Right. Exactly.
Like why?
I referenced for y'all to remember when we were talking about Joe Biden talking about the convention for a future story. It's this one, by the way.
Found it.
Because Joe Biden thinks that it's fine that they're voting.
Yeah.
He said, well, the answer is I'd listen to the scientists. Having a convention, having tens of thousands of people in one arena is very different than having people walk into a polling booth with accurate spacing 6 to 10 feet apart, one at a time, going in and having machines scrubbed down.
First of all, it's adorable that he thinks that that would be how voting was.
Right. Also,
that's not how the
Joe
grocery
Biden,
store is working.
Right. Also, listen to the scientists. Find me. I dare you.
Yeah.
Right now. Find me one. I'm just asking for one. Literally any person who has been to science school to tell me that they think voting in Wisconsin on Tuesday is a great plan.
He will not be able to do that. And I'll tell you why. Because there's not a single scientist out there who would say this is a good idea.
There isn't one.
There's no one. None of them. That's some patented Brain Trust Live trademarked scientific learning from us to you. There is no way that you would find a scientist who like scientists would rather you not have to shop for food right now. They would correct. Scientists would rather that you stay in your home and literally don't have a yeah. reason to exit through your front door for any purpose for the next 2 months.
Right.
Scientists are not hoping that you'll walk into a polling place and touch a machine that every single other person in your town has touched and then right. also touch your face.
And look, I get it. You know, there's been a lot of people sort of like on the you know, fringy elements of the of both parties, really, that are saying that we should go forward with voting because, you know, we can't just be canceling voting because we live in a democracy. And if we start getting into a world where we're like right. not voting, then like we're sort of are we that any longer? I mean, are we anyway? But that's a separate discussion.
Separate. It's a whole but, rabbit hole that we don't have time to go down.
But what I hope that states are doing and also what, I mean, the federal government should be doing also, although I feel like I read something where Trump was pushing back against this, but we need to figure out how we need to be having not just these primary elections, but we need to be looking at what we might have to be doing in November if we're not going to be able to like go to polling places.
I was going
to
say, voting
does
not...
We have to have an election. Like
voting does not have to be canceled for in-person voting to be canceled.
Right.
That's not the same
thing. So I'm hoping that there are plans for that happening. I fear maybe, especially from this administration, there's not. I feel like I saw something where Amy Klobuchar introduced a bill to sort of like fund a federal election. So like, I think that people are thinking about it, but like they need to be thinking hard about it because we can't just do what Joe Biden wants us to and go out and get killed in a
right. well, that's,
democracy you, for voting.
You're that's, literally asking people to risk their lives to vote.
Yeah.
That's like asking them to pay a poll tax that is their lives right. in order to cast a vote.
Yeah.
So let's not do it.
No, we can't do that.
Also, though, speaking of governors who are also not making great choices, I think Brian Kemp from Georgia takes the cake for this week in stupid things.
Oh, man.
He is being a nightmare person.
Yeah.
Obviously. This is a man who stole his election anyway, and now we know why we shouldn't let people get away with that. because he said on Wednesday, this is a state, by the way, that could have had Stacey Abrams as the governor.
Yeah.
That's a world you could have lived in Georgia. Just P.S. But in any case, Brian Kemp said on Wednesday that he had only just learned that asymptomatic individuals can spread the coronavirus still.
Right.
Experts have been saying that since January.
January.
We are already under a mask requirement in L.A. where you have to wear a mask just to go outside here now because asymptomatic individuals can spread the coronavirus.
Right.
He just learned that on Wednesday. Maybe Tuesday.
Yep.
He learned it 24 hours before he announced on Wednesday that he didn't know it 24 hours ago.
Right. Because that's a game changer. That information that we have known for 3 months.
Game changer.
Changed everything.
Yeah. So obviously he then immediately shut everything down in the state, right?
No. Wrong.
Of course not. Of course not.
He did initially, but then he thought to himself, wait a minute. Wouldn't it be great if everybody can keep going to the beaches?
So
he signed an executive order to reopen all of the beaches.
This is a man who closed the beaches and then decided to enact a new policy to reopen them after they had been closed because of a pandemic. So he's That's not it. Someone who just passively let the beaches stay open. He had the correct idea to close the beaches initially and then decided, no, let's change that. I will sign a new law that keeps the beaches open.
Right. And that executive order that he signed actually supersedes all of the local orders.
That's right.
Because a lot of these cities along the coasts had closed beaches already. And now they have to reopen them, even though they had already closed them themselves.
Yeah. So mayors are not happy.
They're pissed.
And a lot of them are saying they're going to do some other... They're going to try to keep the beach closed in sneaky ways, like closing parking lots and beach access roads and things like that. Because they can still do that, but they can't control who is actually on the beach itself.
Yeah.
Which is... It's bananas. All of this is bananas. There's some other bananas things going on.
Yeah.
There are 12 states where you can still go to church.
Right. That have stay-at-home orders. Right? But you can still go to church.
These aren't states that forgot to do a stay-at-home order. These are states that did a stay-at-home order and provided a special religious exemption, even though we know that churches are one of the ways that this virus has spread in many random communities that you wouldn't think would have a big problem with coronavirus.
Totally.
It's also how, like, most of Korea got coronavirus. One person went to one 1,200-person church and gave coronavirus somehow to, like, 1,000 people.
Right, and we've seen it here now, too. I mean, there was a huge outbreak in Kentucky recently, and they're one of the states on this list.
Are other church activities. I mean, there was that choir in Washington where everyone got sick just because they practiced together. So there are so many ways in which inviting people into a room to sing together, for whether they're practicing or just doing it off the cuff, is the wrong idea.
Right. And some of these orders are like trying to have it both ways, sort of like the Colorado order, because that's a Democratic governor. But like I think in their state, it's like, you can go, but you have to social distance while you're there. And there has to be like a digital version, like either on, you know, I went to church this morning, by the way.
But Brent's watching Facebook Live.
I went on Facebook. You know, you have to sort of like be able to give people that option as opposed to like, you know, requiring them to be there, like if they want to come. So there are some states that are like that, which is still ridiculous because like if the doors are open, then like, you know, that's bad. Like, you can't be having people come there. But here are the states that have them. A few of them are states that shouldn't have them.
That's right.
Arizona, Colorado shouldn't have it. I mean, none of them should. But, like, some of these have Democratic governors, which is just
sort
of like...
Some of these are people could know
better. Do better. Right, exactly. Right. So, Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Delaware, Kentucky, Michigan. I mean, really? We're going to go around praising Gretchen Whitmer and then have Michigan on this list. New Mexico, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Texas, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. Back to Wisconsin again.
This is too ridiculous.
Yeah. And by the way, I would like to point out that if we are going to have churches be quote unquote essential businesses, then let's tax them as such.
Correct. Yeah. This is a good example of a time that maybe a reclassification that was specially granted to churches in a pandemic could also be causing reclassifications in other parts of the code.
Let's think about
where we stop allowing churches to not pay any taxes. Yeah. There are also some states that don't even have stay-at-home orders yet.
Ugh.
One being the home state of one Brent Thornburg and purveyor of the t-shirt that I'm wearing today, which says Des Moines on it.
With a palm tree.
The states are Iowa, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota.
Yeah.
They have no stay-at-home orders.
All border each other.
That's going to be a cluster.
Right. They're basically, if we're being honest, the same place.
That's right. I would also note, though, that like, okay, North and South Dakota barely have people in them.
There's not people there.
Nebraska, borderline. But Nebraska has Omaha. Iowa has Des Moines. These are states where, and look, Des Moines looks like it's social distancing even during rush hour. There's a lot of ways in which Des Moines residents are social distancing without knowing it.
Yeah.
But they are not practicing sort of active social distancing because they are still going out and doing life things because they can, right. Well, and they also, should not be.
Right. And also one of the things that we are just sort of like starting to see, which is only going to get worse. This is going to be part of the Pearl Harbor of this week, is that you're seeing rural spread. Because, and there's a few reasons why that is bad. Because,
well,
I mean, it just is. Because you don't want a lot of reasons. Right. But, I mean, a lot of rural communities are, while spread to a degree, are also very insular. Yeah. And we've seen this be a huge problem in very, like, insular communities. And yeah. also, they have oftentimes limited access to healthcare, to hospitals.
They don't have hospitals.
They don't have hospitals.
They don't have any hospitals.
And all of these four states have huge rural communities. I mean, the better part of all four of those states is rural. So when you start seeing rural spread, you're not going to see huge numbers. But, you know, when you have towns of literally hundreds of people that are all not social distancing and all, I read something about how there was a horse auction in Iowa yesterday that 600 people were at, like that, like, you know, I mean, that's ridiculous. You're laughing because it's appropriate to laugh, but also, like, you know, potentially literally all 600 of those people could have coronavirus right now.
Well, and like, I was also
and all 600 of them aren't within 100 miles of a hospital. So
specifically in Iowa, I was also thinking, I'm surprised that Iowa hasn't had a huge outbreak already, because Iowa in January had a huge number of people coming from the coast, and we know cases were already happening on the coast that time.
All the way. That was the first week of February.
Exactly. Up until the first week of February, Iowa was having a huge number of visitors that were coming from places that are now coronavirus hotspots. So I would think Iowa in particular should be really careful about how they protect their citizens from spread, because they likely do have a risk of that. They probably have unidentified cases there because of all of that.
I agree. I think it's just a case of the governor, Kim Reynolds, is really just like digging in her heels, just really to like spite people. Like all of the Democratic Congress people from Iowa have like called for, I mean, she's getting like railed by everyone.
Well, she deserves
all
it,
day for like this decision. And she just like, she has a press conference every day and she's just sort of like not doing it. I mean, she's literally just doing it to, she's not doing it just to not do it at this point.
I think like, also one thing that people aren't really thinking about, and I've been thinking about this only because my parents are riding this out in a rural community that they live in for half the year. People in rural communities really often aren't prepared to take these kinds of extreme collective actions, because that's not really what life in a rural community is like. The, you know, people have huge amounts of land, they have a lot of space, and so they really don't see themselves as being at risk for this kind of thing, and because of that are not going to proactively take social distancing precautions. And we're also talking about rural populations are old.
Right. Also,
it's old people that live in rural America. There's no jobs there. The dairy industry is falling apart. The farming industry is falling apart. These are communities filled with old people who don't have access to hospitals in states that barely have any ventilators. I was looking, you know, there's an interesting website about that sort of tracks the predicted spread of coronavirus in a certain state or, you know, in individual states, and compares it to how many hospital beds and ventilators they have. And some interesting states are going to be dramatically low on needed medical supplies because they are small states who don't, you know, the entire state of Maine has something like 30 or 60 ventilators like or something like that. Right.
Like minimal, like an insanely low ICU amount beds, of ICU not even beds ventilators. Also.
Right. And whereas like a state like California has many more because we have huge hospital systems here. Some of these rural states, I mean, we've been seeing medical, and one of the arguments for a national medical system is that the government can run unprofitable medical centers in rural communities that need them, so that the fact that it's not profitable to run a hospital in rural America doesn't mean they don't have access to healthcare in rural America.
Right.
But you're going to see a lot of rural communities, I think, more so than people in cities who are now seeing firsthand why taking these precautions is so important, are going to be slow on the uptake if we don't message clearly to them. Because they have been up where my parents live. They don't have a lot of cases yet. That's going to change. But because of that, they sort of see themselves as insular. And so they don't think that there's a risk of this outside thing coming in. And there is.
100% there is.
So there's also some states that have like kind of half-assed their stay-at-home orders. Those include Wyoming, Utah, Oklahoma, and South Carolina.
Right.
None surprising. All annoying.
Right. All Republican governors.
All Republican governors.
All of those states.
And three of them states that have people in them.
Right. Yeah.
Wyoming, as far as I'm concerned, can sort of do whatever they want. I don't know what's going on in Wyoming.
Yeah.
I assume that there's cattle.
Sure.
I assume that the cattle is mostly what's going on there.
Yep.
I don't know if people know other people there or if they only know members of cattle farms and cattle families. Whatever. Yeah. I don't know what's going on over there. Dick Cheney is from Wyoming, and that's all that you can really know about that. The list of who has coronavirus is also growing.
Yeah.
There's a CNN outbreak going on.
Right. This is not the definitive list, by the way. This is just some people that we threw onto a list.
Right. Chris Cuomo, notably. Notable in part because he's still recording from his basement, but also notable because he's Andrew Cuomo's brother.
Right. I think he called into the press conference.
He did. He did.
Didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. No, they're having a little bit of a brotherly moment together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Brooke Baldwin, though, also from CNN, is now coronavirus positive.
Yep.
Joe Exotic.
Joe Exotic.
Which is the biggest news of the week, I would say.
Sure is.
Pink has coronavirus. I just learned that right now as I was looking at this list that you wrote.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Didn't know that. But what I did know, because three separate people texted me about it within 1 minute of the news breaking, is that Boris Johnson has been hospitalized now for his coronavirus symptoms. He was diagnosed 10 days ago, and he is now in the hospital. And we are waiting for
the tweeted
news
a couple days ago that he was starting to feel better. Also.
Yeah, well, that's what happens with coronavirus, though.
It is. Yeah.
One of the weird things about coronavirus is that a week in, a lot of people feel better, and then they just crash.
Yep.
So that's also, that's a scary thing about it, too, is that you never really know when you're out of the woods with it.
Right.
Which is why you should avoid getting it. Meanwhile, we continue to punish whistleblowers in the coronavirus world. We didn't apparently learn the lesson from China, whose doctor that tried to warn them about coronavirus then died of coronavirus. But there was a Navy captain, Brett Crozier, who wrote a memo detailing that there was a huge COVID outbreak on his ship and trying to get help from leadership. And instead of giving help to his crew, the acting Navy secretary fired him.
Yep. And Trump got asked about it, and he's also it obviously came from him. But he said at one of his press conferences, he shouldn't have been talking like that. He should be thanking us, blah, blah, blah.
They accused him of creating a panic and, quote, demonstrating extremely poor judgment in the middle of a crisis. I don't know what could be better judgment than alerting officials that there's a health crisis happening on your ship.
Right.
Considering
meanwhile, his entire crew gave him a standing ovation.
Right. His crew gave him a viral video on Friday showed hundreds of sailors from the ship, maybe gathering not with social distancing guidelines, but what can you do? You're on a ship. Applauding him as he exited the ship, disembarked, whatever it's called in ship terms. But the ship is docked in Guam, and so far they have 137 cases on board, but about as many as 3,000 of them are going to be taken off the ship and quarantined on Friday, finally. And Crozier himself has now tested positive, I heard. It was a health crisis that was also hitting him personally. But we should be rewarding people for alerting us to a public health crisis.
Right.
We should not be firing someone who had the presence of mind to try to help protect his 5,000 person crew.
Right.
These are 5,000 people, by the way, that are on the U.S. government payroll. These are our employees. So we, the American people, actually owe them a safe working environment. That is part of our responsibility to them, just as their responsibility to us is to be in the Navy. Our responsibility to them is to provide them as safe a working environment as possible. It is actually our responsibility as their bosses to hope that their captain would speak up if there's a crisis on board and get them help.
Right.
Trump is not their boss. We are their boss. The American people are everyone's boss in this whole situation.
Right. Yeah.
But Trump has also been continuing his war on other whistleblowers because he also let the FBI inspector general go this week because
this was the one that I think that he was really thinking could go under the radar. And it mostly has.
Mostly has. Yeah. Michael Atkinson is who told Congress about the whistleblower complaint that led to the impeachment.
Led to impeachment. Right.
But this is textbook purging. This should not be legal. He can't just rid the government of any foe after he's the one who's broken the law. And he has broken the law. Because what Congress's impeachment vote tells us is that the president broke the law. He did not get, removed from office, but he did break the law. We do know that.
Yeah.
So in all of this news, there is one potential bright spot, and it goes back to some of the governor conversations we were having earlier.
Yeah.
But thanks to Newsom's quick actions, it does look like California may be a model of how early action flattens the curve. Because, you know, we're still having a serious outbreak here. So not to minimize that we still do not have this under control here by any stretch.
No.
But, and you know, we still have limited testing. So the numbers may be, may not be painting a full picture of what's going on.
But that's the case throughout the country, too.
I think we can assume that's a persistent problem no matter where you are providing the tests. But California has California's growth rate for this crisis has been significantly slower than other states that saw outbreaks happen at around the same time. So we should note that California actually had coronavirus cases before New York. So
and actually before the first ones were in the Bay Area. Santa Clara County had like a pretty early outbreak, and that area, even before the statewide stay-at-home order, issued their own stay-at-home order for social distancing.
Yeah, and so they've been
doing it longer than anybody in the country, the Bay Area. Yeah. And then as far as states go, California has been doing it longer than any other state in the country.
Yeah.
And we started before, I think like 3 or 4 days before New York did.
We did.
When we had a far, less dire situation. Yeah, I think that
we started about 10, like if you match the number of cases in both places on the dates that we both started, we started about 10 days earlier on the curve than New York. And we have not seen the kind of exponential growth here. And look, there's a lot of factors because we also live in a car culture. We don't have any cities in California that are as dense as New York. We don't ride public transit as often as New Yorkers do. I mean, there's plenty of reasons that New York would have a harder time getting something like this under control. So this is not like a failing necessarily on the part of New York's leadership. But it does seem like our growth rate has been pretty steadily lower than what we're seeing in some of these other states that are having sudden huge outbreaks. Because it's not just New York now that's having these sudden enormous outbreaks. Detroit has a major cluster. New Orleans has a major cluster. There are some states that are really ill-prepared or cities that are really ill-prepared to deal with this kind of influx of medical emergencies that are facing huge crises that came out of nowhere. Like there was a day in Louisiana where they finally started testing and they found 1,400 new cases in one day.
Yeah.
L.A. has never had a day that big.
We haven't had a day bigger than 700. Half of four. Yeah, so, right. And that was yesterday, and it went down again today.
Right. So we're still seeing our numbers rise, of course, and we're increasing testing. So part of that is we expect to see our numbers rise here.
Right.
But the rate at which they're rising is not, like, there was a day in New York City where the number of known cases rose from 2,300 to 6,000.
Right.
In one day.
There's a few. Sort of, I don't know if fun is the right word, but like websites where they like show you like a bunch of different graphs, and when you look at California's, when you look at the amount of cases that like it seems like we're tracking for, you can track that like against hospital beds. And we always seem to be okay on that front.
Right,
you
it's showing that you we can will track have it against ICU beds.
Right, you can track it against ICU beds. You can track it against ventilators, which I think we're still sort of like technically maybe a little short on, but I think are sort of getting close, or like there's plans for that
also,
or something like that.
If the states start cooperating, they will start moving. Because I know Washington is sending a bunch of ventilators to New York. Like we should start moving ventilators to the hot spots where they're needed.
Right.
Obviously.
Yeah. And I mean,
but
look,
who knows?
The one thing I've heard a lot of people, like you mentioned, that we're sort of like, we are behind on testing. And Newsom has said that. And he sort of has also sort of, I thought it was surprising to me because you don't hear this from national leadership very often. He, said that was his fault. I was like, oh, really? Like that?
So,
that's a new one. Right. You don't get that every day from an elected official. Yeah. But I think the point is, regardless of whether we're behind on testing, what we haven't seen is our healthcare system being overloaded.
Yeah.
That's why you want to flatten the curve. So like, I'm sort of like, would it be nice if we could test every single person in the country and then track all the people that they had been in contact with, and then take the ones who were positive and actually like quarantine them for a certain amount of time and make sure that they were being quarantined. Like, yes, that would all be great.
That's what a smart nation would have done in January, though. We're 3 months in.
Is that what's going to happen? No, that ship has sailed. We're cooked on that front. Like, it's not going to happen. But if we're behind, so that's why I'm sort of like, well, what I do know is that you aren't seeing lines of thousands of people waiting to get into emergency rooms here.
Right.
So, like, I'm almost sort of, like, don't care about the testing because I know that we're never going to get appropriate testing.
Yeah.
Like, that's not going to – we don't live in that world. It's not going to happen. It's
well,
sad.
And this is also –
it could have happened. It should have happened.
Right.
But it didn't and it won't. Yeah. So, like, I think as long as – until I see a report that there aren't any hospital beds left in California, I'm going to assume – regardless of what the numbers are of confirmed cases, that we're doing okay.
Yeah. Or at least as well as you can under the
as
circumstances.
Well as you can.
Our hospitals
right. I mean,
are still being challenged by this,
for
obviously.
Sure.
There was an article, and I think the New York Times or the LA Times, detailing the two hospitals. One is a public hospital, and one is Cedars-Sinai, which is one of the big major medical centers, but also kind of like has a lot of private money. And talking about how they were both finding this situation incredibly challenging in almost similar ways. Cedars is much... has better equipment, has, you know, is better staffed, has has all
I
the
mean,
things
I wish
a rich hospital
were,
would
I
have.
I wish neither of them were finding it challenging, but in a world where it is challenging, I'm glad that they were both finding it equally challenging.
I agree. I was going to say.
Because that's, right.
That's
yeah,
important
right.
because you don't want to be providing a better quality of care to rich people
right.
when it,
because,
in a
well,
crisis
that's been a
where
problem
everyone's
in New
health
York.
Matters.
It's
right,
been
exactly.
The, it's been the public hospitals that have been having the toughest go of it.
One thing, though, that New York does have that some of these cities who are going to get this are not going to have is public hospitals. You want and LA has public hospitals as well, but we don't have as many as we should. And one of the issues with healthcare access in cities is that private hospital systems are gobbling up all of the hospitals. And so, like in New York City, Mount Sinai owns like basically everything in the city, just as Cedars-Sinai and UCLA own everything in the city here. Those have a much higher cost barrier to entry than public hospitals do, who have to treat everyone and have to also have to coordinate with city government in a different way than the private hospitals do. But one thing that they did note in the article is that Cedars-Sinai actually has the largest share of Medicare patients of anyone
in
the city.
I'm surprised by that, actually.
And yeah, I was too. I mean, that's why they wrote it. They were surprised too. But so Cedars-Sinai does, and Cedars-Sinai, I will say, has a really generous sort of program to help tell people who can't afford their bills there pay them. I mean, I had to take advantage of that when I was like 24 and, you know, had a bad, you know, pulmonary situation and had to take an expensive breathing test and couldn't afford to pay the bill. You can actually apply for funding from them and they're pretty generous with that. And I was insured, by the way. It was just because I had a $900 copay on the bill. So in any case, that's off. That's not the point. The point is that
it's a point.
It's a point, right. But the point is that the hospitals are starting to see challenges in California. We're seeing it in both the public and private hospital systems, but we are not seeing what is happening in New York. And we hope not to, obviously.
We hope not to.
And we're still, you know, we're earlier in our curve, but our curve is happening more slowly than their curve, too, which is important. You know, there's 10 million people in L.A. County. And so it's a lot.
Right.
It's still a lot of people.
I think we've got
it's
like
half
what,
as many people
got,
as
like,
New York. But
I think we've got like 6,000 cases or something like that.
Now. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, that's it does seem like we are at least seeing some benefits from the early action on the state level.
Which is like, why, if you're Kim Reynolds in Iowa,
just do it.
Just do it. It's like, what's the, I mean, it's. What's
also,
the...
it's not like you uniquely lose out on economic activity. Everyone's fucked.
No one is working. Right. I know.
So it's not like you. It's not like your state's economy is going to uniquely suffer. We're all just in a terrible situation. And this is this whole pandemic is a good reminder of why we settle into societies. It is not so that we can all steal resources from each other. It is so that we can cooperate when there's an emergency. So act like it. At the federal level, act like it. The reason we have a federal government is to help us band together and cooperate during an emergency so that needed healthcare supplies can get to the people who need them.
I mean,
it is not so that we can have states outbid each other for the things that keep their doctors and nurses safe. You know, the whole reason to have a society is to share. Like, sorry about it. There's no other reason to do it. That's it.
Yeah.
Millions of years ago. This is what this is how humans are different than other species. Like, you know, is because we can articulate this. But like, if you are mad about things that are old concerns of ours, things like paying taxes, things like having the government in your business, just remember that the only reason to live anywhere is to have access to that kind of cooperation.
Right.
That's the whole point of having a government. In any case, on that note.
That's it.
Now that I've speculated about the nature of government, we will talk to you next week from our homes once again.
Yes.
And we will...
Oh, it'll once be Easter. Again, I'll tell you the story of Easter next week. It'll be so fun.
I was going to say, one tradition that we do like to maintain on this podcast is an in-depth question and answer session about the story of Easter.
Yeah.
And we will be doing that again. So stay tuned. Bye.
Bye.